Welcome to the Diplomat's podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm your host, Ankit Panda, associate editor of the Diplomat, and co-hosting with me today is Shannon Tiezi, our resident China expert and editor. And I'm very happy to announce that we have a guest with us today on the podcast. Please welcome Dr. Joel Witt. Joel is a senior fellow at the U.S.-Korea Institute at Zeiss Johns Hopkins University and is the founder and editor of 38 North. Now, if you're a Diplomat reader and you're interested in North Korea, I would very much recommend that you keep an eye on 38 North. It's an invaluable resource for anybody interested in observing North Korean issues. Joel is an internationally recognized expert on Northeast Asian security issues and nonproliferation with 20 years of experience at the U.S. State Department and the Washington think tank arena. Additionally, we're very lucky to have him with this timing because he's been in the news quite a bit since he is one of the authors of a new report on North Korea's nuclear program that's generated considerable buzz. So Joel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
So Joel, I think a good place to start with this podcast would be to just give you an opportunity to discuss the projections that you make in the North Korea Nuclear Futures Project. Obviously, it's generated some buzz. I've seen a lot of headlines saying that American researchers say North Korea will have 100 nuclear weapons by 2020. And you know, obviously, there's more nuance to this report. So why don't you just let our listeners get a sense of what you and your colleagues have projected regarding North Korea's nuclear program?
Sure. So this is the first product of this project, the North Korea Nuclear Futures Project, which is going to last to the end of this year. And it's the product of the first workshop we held at the end of last year. And that product, the workshop basically focused on North Korea's technology for its nuclear and missile programs. And also, what strategy may be emerging for the use of nuclear weapons. The bottom line is, and I guess the part of it that's gotten the most attention is that, you know, North Korea is about to rapidly expand its nuclear weapons stockpile. And, of course, there are a lot of uncertainties in predicting the future of North Korea in general and its WMD programs in particular. So what we've done is we've constructed three scenarios that take us out to 2020. And what you've seen in the news is, of course, people have focused on the worst case scenario, which is 100 nuclear weapons by 2020. In fact, there are two other scenarios as well. There's a low end scenario where things don't go that well for the North Koreans, and they'd have 20 nuclear weapons by 2020, which is basically 100% expansion of their current stockpile. And the medium scenario, which is basically a continuation of their current trajectory, the medium scenario is 50 nuclear weapons by 2020. None of these outcomes are, of course, very good, and I think they're all very dangerous. Having 100 is obviously pretty bad, and once again, that's the worst case. It may be possible, but it is the worst case scenario.
And at the event, at the sort of press launch of this report on Tuesday, you mentioned a fourth scenario, you called it, which is North Korea doesn't do any more nuclear tests. They don't do any more missile tests, but they still are continuing to expand their nuclear weapons and missiles along their current technological prowess level. And you said that that was also a very dangerous scenario.
Well, I thanks for bringing that up, Shannon. Actually, I think that is extremely important because most of the public attention on North Korea is it happens when North Korea either conducts a nuclear test or a long-range rocket test. And people assume that's a sign of continuing development of the threat, which it is. But even if North Korea didn't conduct another nuclear test, it could still build up to 100 nuclear weapons. Nuclear tests have nothing to do with the numbers of weapons that North Korea is building. It has to do with their sophistication. But the numbers are unaffected by nuclear tests. And on the missile front, if there's no more long-range rocket tests, that probably means that North Korea won't be able to develop systems, reliable systems that'll reach the United States. But the North Koreans today have over 1,000 missiles that can carry nuclear weapons and attack targets in the region. So this idea that testing means progress, no testing means nothing's happening, is just wrong.
How successful would you say the North Koreans have been? Well, I mean, obviously we don't know for sure, but at miniaturizing a warhead and making it deliverable by an ICBM or an IRBM?
You know, the fact is most experts I know who aren't in the U.S. or South Korean government will tell you that North Korea can certainly put a warhead on top of the Nodong missile, which is a medium-range ballistic missile that can certainly reach South Korean targets, but also Japan as well. And missiles like the Scud, they can also do it for that. And I think they could also do it for a clunky ICBM that they might deploy in an emergency based on the Unha space launch vehicle. So, you know, I don't know what's going on inside governments. I don't know what kinds of politics are occurring. But the fact is, most technical experts will tell you they can do it. And they can do it in part because they've been working on it for 30 years. Mm-hmm. They've been working on it since the late 1980s. And unless they're incredibly incompetent, they can do it.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the scenarios that you described, something that interests me is obviously the probabilities that you assign to each scenario. I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, each scenario is based on underlying assumptions. Underlying assumptions in terms of the amount of fissile material they can produce. Underlying assumptions in terms of, and I'm talking about the nuclear projections now, underlying assumptions in terms of the nuclear test program and how many nuclear tests are conducted. There are underlying assumptions about how successful they are in acquiring certain technologies from overseas that they need to acquire. So we apply these assumptions to each scenario, and, you know, I could get into a lot of gory detail, but you know, if you're looking at the low-end scenario, things aren't going so well for them. And in the high-end scenario, everything's going great. And in the medium scenario, it's pretty much the way things are going now. Mm-hmm. So that's how we basically came up with these projections.
Okay. Now, from what I know, most of North Korea's technical expertise in its nuclear program is based around its plutonium program, but its uranium program is definitely burgeoning, and there is progress in that area. Do your scenarios sort of – is that one of your assumptions, that North Korea starts to accelerate its progress on its uranium program and its plutonium program at a similar rate, or are these projections sort of agnostic of the plutonium-uranium question?
No. They're very much based on assumptions about – how successful the North Koreans are in, you know, further developing plutonium production and uranium, weapons-grade uranium production. So, for example, in the low-end scenario, we assume that North Korea is having problems with producing plutonium, and we've seen that from some of our commercial satellite photography analysis where the operating plutonium production reactor is having problems. And also in the low-end scenario, we assume that their uranium enrichment program is at a minimal level. You know, it's has one operating facility with a limited amount of centrifuges operating. So that's the low end. At the high end, it's, of course, a very different picture. You know, the plutonium production reactor is working perfectly. In addition to that, they have another reactor they've been working on for civilian energy purposes, but that's diverted to producing plutonium. And on top of that, they would have two plants producing weapons-grade uranium. including newer models of the machines that produce the weapons-grade uranium called centrifuges, newer models that would be very similar to the most modern Pakistani models that are producing weapons-grade uranium. So, you know, we have a broad range here, and I think the assumptions are very realistic. And I want to add to this that I didn't do these projections. I'm in charge of the project, but they were done by David Albright, who's president of the Institute for Science and International Security, and who has been doing these kinds of projections for maybe 20, 25 years for a whole bunch of countries, not just North Korea. Mm-hmm. So he knows what he's doing.
Absolutely. One thing I want to touch on is the degree to which international policies at keeping foreign technology out of North Korea have failed. It's clear they have failed, but I mean, to what degree, and how can the United States or, you know, other actors in the international community ensure that it's more difficult for North Korea to access foreign technology?
Well, look, there's no doubt that our efforts have failed. And, you know, I might even go as far as saying they failed miserably. You know, I often use the analogy that we're like the federal regulators who were watching Wall Street, and the North Koreans are like the traders on the street who are always two steps ahead of the regulators. And that's been the case in terms of their acquisition of technologies abroad for both the nuclear program and the missile program. So we're not doing a very good job of that. The UN sanctions in place now, I think, have also failed. They're not doing a good job of it. And on top of that, the big problem, or one of the big problems, is that the Chinese really aren't clamping down on the flow of technology through their country into North Korea. So the overall picture is one that is not very good, and I'm not sure exactly how to improve it, except that, of course, if China played a more active role in dealing with this problem, it might help. But to be fair to the Chinese, they have a very significant problem, and that is, you know, when we've talked to the Chinese about this, they look at us and say, we have over a million companies in our country. How can we deal with that and stop the flow of technology to the degree you want us to stop it? And, you know, I think that's a fair point, but the bottom line is I don't think they're really trying very hard.
Mm-hmm. But there's been a lot of commentary over the past year that relations between North Korea and China have declined somewhat. Obviously, this started with Jang Song-taek's execution in late 2013, and it's been building since then. How important of an item do you think Korean Peninsula denuclearization is in Chinese foreign policy right now? And Shannon, obviously, feel free to chime in here as well.
You know, I've been working on this issue for probably too long. So I've been doing it since the 1993. And of course, China has always been a factor in U.S. policy. So during the first nuclear crisis, we had very good cooperation with the Chinese. They were very actively involved in helping us out. And that continued for a while. I think it continued till at least the middle of the next decade. But under this administration, my sense is that there really hasn't been good cooperation, that the Obama administration has basically been sending a message to the Chinese that they need to put more pressure on North Korea. And the Chinese have been sending a message to us saying that we need to talk more and engage the North Koreans more. And there may be some overlap. There may be some areas where there has been some cooperation. But I think overall that hasn't been the case. And unfortunately, I feel that the Chinese are on a slippery slope to basically living with a nuclear North Korea. And they're not really placing a high priority on denuclearization. their priority is on maintaining stability on the Korean Peninsula and on their borders.
Mm-hmm. Shannon, do you agree with that point of view?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And that's the sense that, or the message I've gotten from Chinese analysts that I've talked to, is that the U.S. and China have the same interests. They both want to see denuclearization. They both want to see stability, but the priorities are very different. The U.S., their top priority is denuclearization. For China, it's stability. And that completely changes the way that both sides approach the issue of denuclearization, because China is not going to take any steps aimed at denuclearization that it feels are going to cause instability. So, you know, really strict sanctions. Or, it even refused to call out North Korea for the sinking of the South Korean ship, the Cheonan, back in 2010, because it felt that that would be a step too far. So for China, it's how far it's willing to go to prevent denuclearization is limited. And that in turn limits the cooperation that the U.S. and China can have on this issue.
Mm-hmm. You know, I would note, I would just want to add one point, because I talk to Chinese government officials quite frequently, and, you know, I don't want to be too unfair here. I certainly understand their view, and I would note that during 2013, the Chinese actually undertook an active mediation effort with the North Koreans and with Washington to try to jumpstart the six-party talks. So, you know, they were talking to the North Koreans, they were talking to the Americans. They were trying to figure out, you know, what conditions under which might these talks resume, because the United States had a number of preconditions. And at the end of the year, by the end of the year, that had failed miserably. And I think the Chinese were very unhappy and very frustrated, not just with the North Koreans, but with Washington also.
Mm-hmm. Just in the context of this discussion we're having, I wanted to bring up the issue of the statement released yesterday after talks between Chinese State Councilor Yang Jiechi and U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice. It actually was quite remarkable. Shannon and I were talking about it earlier this morning. It was the first statement, to my knowledge, where China joined the United States in explicitly rebuking North Korea's Byung-jin line that Pyongyang will aspire to have both economic growth and an active nuclear program, which is something that I believe, Joel, you've criticized in the past that U.S. policy is currently allowing North Korea to succeed at that. What do you make of this statement, if anything?
Well, you know, first of all, I got to read the exact words, and I honestly, after yesterday's release of the report, I haven't had any time to read the exact words.
Mm-hmm.
Words are cheap. How many times have we had joint statements between the United States and the Chinese, and Washington says, look, there's progress here? I mean, when President Xi first came here for the Sunnylands summit, everyone was saying after that, wow, you know, looks like China has shifted its position on North Korea. And in fact, it hadn't shifted its position.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a tactical move. So I don't know if this is a tactical move or not, but the fact is there's no evidence whatsoever that, you know, China has taken steps to cut back significantly economic cooperation with North Korea. Moreover, it's very clear to me that the North Koreans, while they are very much dependent on China, are also developing other sources of support around the world. And, you know, Exhibit A is Russia. We don't know exactly what's going to go on there, but, you know, I think people are very nervous about how that relationship might develop. And, of course, there are other countries in the international community, countries in the non-aligned movement and developing world, where North Korea has very good ties with these countries. So, you know, we're not talking about North Korea becoming like South Korea through economic development, but it doesn't take much, I think, for North Korea's underdeveloped economy to make progress.
Right, right. The exact words, just so you know, they don't use the term Byung-jin line, but they say the two of them affirmed their commitment to the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and agreed that North Korea would not succeed in its twin pursuit of nuclear weapons and economic development. Just putting that out there. Let's talk
about. Sounds nice, but once again, words are cheap.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one point that you made on Tuesday, Joel, that I thought was really interesting was that this U.S. insistence that North Korea can't do both develop nuclear weapons and develop its economy is just has proven to be not true. They are doing both. So this U.S. insistence that they have to choose is ringing more and more hollow.
Yeah, that's exactly the case. I mean, just look at the findings of the report and then look at what's been going on in terms of the North Korean economy, in terms of its agricultural sector. It's making some progress there. And, you know, so I think for the North Koreans, it's good enough. They'd like to do better, of course. And if there weren't, you know, international sanctions against them, they could do better. But, you know, this is North Korea we're talking about. We're not talking about Western Europe or South Korea or Japan. So their standards for success may be very lower than our standards for success.
Right. Yeah, I don't think North Korea has posted a GDP growth rate greater than 2% since 2005, if I have that correctly. I think it's usually been around 1% or just under that. It's been negative a few years, too. Anyways, just in the final segment of this podcast, I want to take the conversation over to U.S. policy towards North Korea. Joel, in your view, how productive has the current stance by the United States, at least this administration, on preconditions for talks with North Korea been? Do you think the next administration needs to try a completely different approach? And if so, what approach?
Well, look, you know, I think sometimes I may be unnecessarily harsh and critical of the administration. So what I'd like to say first is that this is a very difficult problem to deal with. I mean, that may sound obvious, but, you know, I think it needs to be reemphasized. Secondly, during this administration, there have been some events that have made it very difficult to deal with North Korea. The events of 2010 in particular, with the sinking of the Chunan and the artillery attack on South Korea. And then, of course, there's the collapse of the Leap Day deal in 2012, although I think the whole story of that is a lot less black and white than the administration presents. So this is a very hard problem. I mean, okay, that's very obvious. But I don't see that as an excuse to put aside U.S. national interests. And essentially, I think that's what's happened during this administration. It's kind of written this off, kicked the ball down the road. It's focused on other issues. It just hopes this one doesn't appear on the front pages of newspapers. And it's trying to skate through until the end. And our report, I think, emphasizes that, in fact, that's been a serious mistake. So what should the administration do? Well, first of all, I think it's artificial and not right to say that policy should be engagement or not engagement. No one's saying that, or at least no one I know is saying that, and that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that we don't have any diplomacy with North Korea. Our sanctions are ineffective. I suspect that the military measures we're taking in view of what's going on in North Korea aren't significant enough, and we're going to have to take more to protect our allies. So what we need to do is to be thinking about all three of those different components and try to beef up what we're doing. So if we want to go into the area of diplomacy, I think there was a time over the past few years when the U.S. could have had contacts with North Korea to discuss what might be possible in six-party talks. Contacts without preconditions to discuss what might have been possible if talks resumed, formal talks resumed. Unfortunately, we haven't done that. We haven't had those contacts. And I know there were some recent reports about the possibility of contacts, which, quite frankly, I found kind of comical because people couldn't agree who would meet with whom where. If you're serious, you can deal with those issues. But, you know, nothing happened. And I think this is gradually sliding out of our control to the point where nothing may be possible until a U.S. new administration comes into office. And even then, I'm not sure a U.S. administration is going to want to deal with this problem either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially one issue I think about is that the current administration has staked out so much political capital on the Iran process, and that's been deeply unpopular domestically. And it's difficult to imagine being able to add on a credible North Korean process with at the same time. Just a final question before we conclude this podcast is the six-party talks. If there is another international talks process return on the North Korean issue, nuclear issue, do you think it will look like the six-party talks that we saw before, or is this going to be a completely different beast given the current dynamics with Russia and the West and Russia and North Korea and even Japan and obviously U.S.-China relations?
Well, look, I have friends who talk about the six-party talks in very disparaging terms, say they're a waste of time, we shouldn't have these kinds of discussions. I disagree. The six-party talks are useful as a forum where all the concerned countries can come together. But having said that, what we need are separate sets of talks depending on the issue involved. So if we're talking about the nuclear issue, I would argue that is largely a U.S.-North Korea issue that needs to be dealt with not solely bilaterally, but very much in the bilateral context. If we're talking about, talks to replace the armistice with a permanent peace treaty on the peninsula, then we're probably talking about four-party talks with the United States, South Korea, China, and North Korea. And there are other probably, variations depending on the subject. So the six-party talks act as a sort of place where everyone can come together and review what's been going on and maybe discuss next steps.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Joe, well, thank you so much for your time and for joining us on this podcast. This was really an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
Yeah, and we hope to have you back on in the future. And for everybody listening to this podcast, just if you're interested in North Korean issues and learning more about the stuff, do keep an eye on 38 North. They do some great stuff over there, very informed analysis. Thanks a lot again, Joel.